It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. I'm Francis Lamb. This week, we've got a whole show on three simple ingredients: peppers, onions, and butter. Now, you put the three together, and that sounds like fun to me, but really, each of these foods deserves their own time to shine. So we're going to talk to a writer who thinks the best butter maker in the world might be a woman in Vermont who tries to figure out how her cows are emotionally. And we'll hear about an entire cookbook devoted to onions. But first, we're going to go where chili peppers want to go when they die. So you know that beer commercial with the guy they call the most interesting man in the world? Like, I don't really think that guy sounds so interesting, honestly. I mean, all he's got to say is buy this beer, but I'm not here for that guy. I'm here for someone else who might be the most interesting woman in the world. Maricel Precia is a native of Cuba and a national treasure of New Jersey. She's the daughter of a brilliant artist and a mother to two brilliant talking macaws. She's one of the world's most respected experts on chocolate, has a PhD in medieval Spanish history, and oh, by the way, yeah, happens to be a James Beard award-winning chef. And so she wrote the book on the food of the Latin world, called La Gran Cocina Latina, and is an expert in chili peppers. So we caught up with her for a lesson in dried pepper pastes, these incredibly aromatic flavor boosters you can use to season braises and roasts and pots of rice. So we headed to her home, and I have to tell you, when we walked in, it was like a cabinet of wonders, right? That every inch of her walls is covered in beautiful paintings and artwork. And there were tables full of literally 300 kinds of potted peppers that she's growing. And all the shelves of her kitchen are stacked with French copper pots and South American mortars and pestles. And the birds are cackling and the dogs are running around. And we began a lesson on one of the building blocks of Latin cooking, these workhorse sauces made from dried chilies. So thank you so much for having us here, Maricel.
Welcome to my home kitchen.
This kitchen is incredible. Everywhere I look, there's beautiful copper pans and pots, and there are artifacts from all over the world. There, you have the most incredible macaws in the next room over.
And they're quiet, which is miraculous.
Yeah. We might hear them talk to us later. But we're here today because we want to talk to you about the things you think anyone who wants to cook like a Latino or Latina cook should know how to make. What are those things?
Exactly. I want to say that Latin cooking is very structured. I mean, we might seem very casual. We like to eat everything on a single plate, for example, but we are structured, and there are certain techniques that are absolutely essential to Latin cooking. You'll find them in different countries, you know, with different touches, but the foundation is very basic. And I'm talking about essentially two things: the adobo, which is a marinade, and most of our food, including rice dishes, depend on a cooking sauce that we call sofrito. You marinate a piece of meat and then you braise it in a sofrito.
So I know you said there are many different versions of adobos and sofritos around the Latin world. Talk to us about one of your favorite adobos.
Well, when I get home from the market, and let's say that I bring a steak or maybe fish, my instinctive reaction is to grab the mortar and pestle and just crush garlic to a paste together with black peppercorns, allspice, because I'm from Eastern Cuba, where there is a tradition of using allspice. I put some salt, and then I add cumin. I add a little bit of oregano and Seville orange juice. When I don't have Seville orange juice, I go for orange juice with a little bit of lime. And sometimes I add the zest of a grapefruit just to approximate the flavor of Seville orange. So with that, I basically marinate everything. But this technique basically comes from the Spanish Middle Ages. You know, we hear the word adobo in medieval Spanish texts. They did not use maybe the citrus juice. In some cases, they used vinegar. And they didn't use allspice, because allspice is from the New World, but they used black peppercorns.
So adobo is the first step. It's the first layer of flavor, and you've marinated your meats or fish in that. Now you want to talk to us about the second, which is the sofrito. Can you describe a basic sofrito for us?
Well, I like to make a simple sofrito. I just scrape some of the excess adobo from the meat. I brown the meat. Once it's brown, I put it aside. And then in my pan, I saute garlic, usually onions. And then I add, according to the recipe, I add different things. I add, you know, more cumin, maybe more allspice or oregano or anything that appeals to me in terms of, you know, aroma. And then I add maybe tomato sauce or fresh tomatoes, a little wine. If I'm cooking a recipe, let's say from coastal Colombia, I might add a little bit of coconut milk. And then I add the meat, bring back the meat into the pot. And so the combination of elements, you know, the fact that the meat already has flavor of its own. And then the cooking sauce and then the juices exuded by the meat mixing, you know, with the sofrito and the adobo, that's what makes great flavor.
Oh, that sounds amazing. I think you wanted to talk about a particular Puerto Rican or Dominican sofrito.
Well, the Puerto Rican and Dominican interpretation of all this is really fascinating. They start with something they call recado. And essentially, it's a flavoring base composed of three important ingredients, culantro, which is a broad leaf, cilantro, and ají dulce, which is absolutely wonderful.
It's a beautiful, you know, green pepper. It looks like a patty pan
exactly.
squash.
Exactly, yes. Yeah. You can buy this in the Hispanic bodegas, and you will always find it together with cilantro and culantro. What Puerto Rican cooks do is that they put in the blender, make a paste with this. But in many cases, they do a more complex type of recado. So they might have another sweet green pepper. It could be green bell pepper, it could be the cubanel. They might add some garlic to it. They might add chopped tomatoes or tomato sauce or paste. And that's a very complete seasoning paste. They keep it in the refrigerator. Something similar to the Puerto Rican version is called sazon in the Dominican Republic, but it's you know, it's kept in the refrigerator. It's a very precious ingredient.
Yeah. So far we've been talking about fresh ingredients, but you want to show us something with dry chilies as well, right?
Absolutely. So we discussed the world of fresh peppers in the Hispanic Caribbean, but in Peru, the two most important ingredients for a cooking sauce are dry peppers. Ají mirasol, which is a beautiful yellow pepper, and ají panca.
Yeah, so this looks like the kind of chilies you might find in a Latin store, maybe a Mexican store, these like really beautiful lacquered looking dried chilies.
Absolutely. And I'm very picky about, you know, when I buy my ají panca, because I don't want something that is completely dried and lifeless. I want a little bit of flexibility in the chili. So that's very important.
Yeah, and the color of it is still vibrant. You can still see a lot of shine in the skin.
Exactly. But this is the foundation to cook Latin food from the Hispanic Caribbean down to Peru. The adobo is the first one, the marinade. The recado, which is a flavoring base for something we call a sofrito. And the third is the Peruvian version of the sofrito called aderezo, which uses as a building block dry pepper.
And you're going to show us how to make that.
Absolutely. Let's go back to the kitchen.
Okay, so now you have this beautiful bowl of, well, these are ají panca, but this is a technique you would use for any
exactly,
dry chili.
Exactly, for any dry chili. That's why this is very useful, because you can replace ají panca with guajillo or ancho. The technique is always the same. And what I do is that I wash the peppers. I rinse them. And people might say that I'm crazy, but I'm not, because I've seen what happens to peppers when they're drying on the ground and when they are kept in stores, you know, loosely. So what I do is, you know, just very quick rinse.
Just a quick rinse, yeah.
Yes. So so you can see that the water might be a little bit dark. It shows, you know, about the dust. So I do this first, and I might just leave the peppers to dry on their own. The reason why I don't want them to be wet when I seed them is because then the seeds get stuck to your fingers, you know, and it's messy. So to seed them, I simply use scissors. You know, I just cut
the stem
end. Yeah, and then you can sort of go lengthwise.
So you're splitting it open
with
the
scissors. Just split it open, exactly. And just, it's very simple with the ají panca. Yeah.
Just open it up and
exactly,
scrape
the seeds out. And if I were to dry roast the peppers. I would open them, you know, would butterfly them and just press them flat. If I were a Mexican, I would probably do that. I would get a comal or a dried skillet, and I would just
toast the dried chili.
Toast them lightly. But the Peruvians don't do that. So what they do is that immediately after they see the peppers, they either boil them until they are reconstituted. So that might take 15 to 20 minutes.
Okay.
So exactly. Or simply you can soak them, cover them with water and let them soak for 20 to 30 minutes until they're soft.
Okay.
Once the ají is soft to the touch, what you do is that you drain it and you always keep some of the water because you're going to need it for the sofrito. So yeah. For this recipe that calls for 6 ají pancas, you need to reserve about a cup.
And that water has
that
really
water
nice flavor.
Has a lot of beautiful flavor. So place your peppers in the blender. I do large batches of this, you know, so it's always good to have a powerful blender. So here we are, you know, it doesn't take much in this very powerful blender. So here it is, you know, it's just very beautiful. And it has this
beautiful brick red
gorgeous
color. Yeah.
It looks like jam.
Yeah, doesn't, totally looks like jam, yeah.
Now, just get your skillet ready. And it's important, you know, I like to heat the skillet at the oil, and then, you know, I really need the oil almost to be sizzling.
Mm. So you want the oil to be sort of
exactly
shimmery hot.
Exactly. And we start with garlic. And we cook it for about 20 seconds. Some people don't like to do this because they're scared of burning the garlic, and sometimes they would add the onions first, all right? But I like to cook the garlic first. Then you follow You follow with red onions. And notice that it's very important for in regional flavor to use the right onion. You know, in the Hispanic Caribbean is mostly the yellow onion. But in Peru and Bolivia, it's red onions.
Oh, interesting.
They think it's more flavorful.
Yeah.
So when I'm making a sofrito, it's not just a question of stirring the onions and the garlic very lightly and then add the other ingredients. No, you need to basically caramelize the onions. So I might cook this for about 10 minutes until the onions are golden and beautifully sweet because they caramelize.
Yeah. And you have the onions cut fairly fine. This is like
fine,
a nice fine
cut, yes.
Fine diced onion. So in 10 minutes, it'll release a lot of juice.
They will. Once you get to that stage, you add your seasoning ingredients. And I like cumin, which is very important in Peruvian cooking. I like then to add my salt. And notice that there's always an acid element in this cooking sauces.
Mm-hmm.
For the Puerto Rican recado, vinegar is really important. For the Cuban, it's Seville orange, but for the Peruvians, it's red wine vinegar.
Okay.
Or it could be chicha, you know, which is
fermented pineapple.
Exactly,
right?
Corn thing.
Okay.
That also is a seasoning. So I just added a drop, like teaspoon of the red wine vinegar. Only when all of these elements have been integrated, do I add
the ají puree?
The ají puree. You know, in this case, it's like half a cup. And then I stir it to blend. And I cook it down for about 5 minutes.
Okay.
And at this point, I add about a cup.
Some of that chili cooking liquid.
Of the reserve liquid.
From boiling
the hot peppers, which is very flavorful and also beautiful. But this has to cook down.
So to recap, this is very simple. You clean the peppers, you boil them or soak them just to hydrate them. You pureed them. And now you have your base of sauteed garlic, sauteed onion, a little cumin, a little bit of vinegar, some salt. You add that pureed paste back in. And now you're cooking it down to it. It's this gorgeous deep red brick color. It smells incredible. It smells toasty and it smells sweet and it smells fruity. It smells all these things. And that you use as your base for. You can use a couple of tablespoons to flavor a pot of rice, or like use it to flavor a whole chicken stew. But that flavor is going to carry you through many different dishes in a meal.
Absolutely, you got it. Now you can cook like a Peruvian.
Thank you so much, Maricel.
Such a pleasure to have you in my kitchen and Latinize your style a little bit.
I could use it.
Maricel Precia is the author of Peppers of the Americas, and she left us with recipes for a basic dried pepper paste and for a totally non-basic dish called Big Tamal Pie filled with chicken and chili ancho sauce. You can find them both at splendidtable.org. And coming up, America's Test Kitchen takes on Colorado green chili, and can there possibly be a butter that sells for $50 a pound? I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. I'm Francis Lamb. So before, when we were cooking with Maricel, we learned about the magic of reducing dried peppers down to an intense, fruity paste. But this week, America's Test Kitchen takes us in a different direction, charring and pureeing fresh peppers to focus their bright green flavors. It's a fantastic match for braised pork, and our producer Sally Swift talked with ATK's Tucker Shaw about their recipe for Colorado green chili.
Hey Tucker, great to have you back.
Hey Sally, it's good to be back.
I want to talk about chili today, as in the soup or the stew, because that word means different things in different parts of the country. And you guys came up with a Colorado green chili recipe that I am really interested in because it's based on those beautiful chilies that you only find in New Mexico in the fall. Tell me about this recipe.
It's true. This is an unusual chili in the pantheon of chilies in that it's not very chunky. There's no beans in it. It doesn't have ground meat or anything like that. It has a really, really strong and beautiful flavor of the green chilies that do grow in New Mexico and southern Colorado. And having lived in Colorado for many, many years, it's something that I find, so rewarding to even think about, let alone eat.
It's those mysterious hatch chilies that only grow in that soil. And these are the chilies that if you are lucky enough to be in New Mexico in the fall, you smell being roasted. And it is absolutely intoxicating.
There is a beautiful, beautiful cloud of this roasty aroma just floating over that whole stretch from Denver all the way down to El Paso. And we're talking about 600 or 700 miles of kind of green chili country. And it just, as you say, is intoxicating and mesmerizing and so wonderful.
So talk to me about this recipe, because how are you guys duplicating that essence of that chili?
Well, unfortunately, duplication is not possible because it is too difficult to get proper green chilies in other parts of the country. So what we had to do was to create a stand-in, sort of a stew that's inspired by the proper green chili. We chose Anaheim chilies for this recipe because they are an offshoot of the proper green chili. They were developed in the early 20th century from chilies from New Mexico. Now, they're a bit more mild, so we had to bolster our stew with a few jalapenos just for an extra hit of spice.
That was very smart of you. So how does the chili come together?
Here's how it comes together. We chose to go for a very meaty chili because we wanted ours to be a meal, not just a drizzle or a condiment. So we start with 3 pounds of pork shoulder, and that's the common meat that you will find in this chili. And you chop that up into, you know, bite-sized chunks, and you start to brown it in a Dutch oven and put that on the back burner to start cooking. Meanwhile, you're going to take about 2 pounds of Anaheim chilies and slice them right down the middle and roast them in the oven alongside 3 jalapenos that you've done the same with. And you've removed the seeds from those as well. And you're going to roast them for about 20 minutes. And this will get the skins very blistered and sort of charred a little bit. And once they've finished roasting, you'll cool them down a bit and remove those skins.
Mm-hmm.
Your next step is to chop about half of those Anaheim chilies into big chunks. and then put the other half into a food processor with some diced tomatoes, and you give those a blitz. And this will help distribute the chili flavor throughout the stew, but also mm-hmm. leave behind some chunks so that you can get a nice mouthful of chili here and there as well. Once you've, you know, chopped the chilies and pureed them, and once your pork shoulder is brown, you're going to toss in some aromatics, onion and garlic, the basics, mm-hmm. and then a bit of flour, which will help thicken your stew just enough. And again, you don't want it really, really thick. This is a fairly thin stew, but it has a great deal of flavor. But nonetheless, you do need to have a little bit of body to this stew. So in go the chilies, in goes some chicken stock. You scrape up the fond that's developed on the bottom of your Dutch oven from that pork, and you bring it to a simmer and slip it in the oven, in a very low oven, for about an hour or so, maybe a few minutes more. The reason we do this in the oven is because we're trying to avoid scorching on the bottom of the pot, which, you know, can be very vexing.
Sounds super simple and smart.
And at this point, your kitchen, Sally, is going to be filled with the kind of aroma that will just make you feel like you're on the best vacation ever. And just thinking about this actually brings a smile to my face. I lived for many years in Colorado, and each autumn, just this aroma, which is just, you know, ubiquitous throughout the city and throughout that whole part of the country, is just the best. So once this is finished sort of simmering away in your oven and you're just about ready to eat, you roughly chop those jalapenos that you roasted in the oven and toss them in. And this will give a sort of a final, you know, jolt of spice.
Yeah.
Just to kind of wake the whole thing up. It's a really remarkable stew because it has so much depth of flavor, but also a really, really vigorous spice.
And sounds like something that can be made ahead and will, of course, be better the longer it waits for you. It sounds like perfect fall cooking, particularly with peppers in the market, right?
I totally agree. And you can make it ahead. And I happen to like this stuff, especially on snowy days. So if you find yourself making it and sticking some in the freezer for that first snowfall of the year, nothing reminds me of Colorado more than a snowy day with some delicious green chili.
Oh man, that's a great idea. Thanks, Tucker.
Thank you, Sally.
Tucker Shaw leads the Cook's Country team at America's Test Kitchen. You can find their recipe for Colorado green chili at splendidtable.org. Now, Alex Halberstadt is a writer I really love to read because he's the kind of writer who can take things I don't think I'm interested in and make them totally fascinating. And so when he wrote a story recently for Saveur about butter, which, you know, I am inherently interested in, I sat down with it right away. And it was a little heartbreaking, honestly, because the best butter he found cost $50 a pound, meaning it will never see my refrigerator. But I knew I wanted to talk with him about what makes great butter great. Alex, thanks so much for coming in.
Great to be here, Francis.
So Alex, you wrote a story about phenomenal, unique butters. And I have to ask, what makes a great butter great?
Well, I think throughout human history, we've had a pretty awesome relationship with butter. I mean, the human race has held butter in really, really high regard. If you think about it, you know, the Tibetans still make sacred sculptures out of butter. The ancient Scandinavians used to be buried with barrels of butter in their coffin. Hmm. And I think that's because people saw butter as something almost miraculous. And I think we've largely forgotten that. Hmm. Because honestly, I don't think anybody wants to be buried with a stick of Land O'Lakes. I think one thing for me that makes butter worth thinking about is that it's not cheese or pastry. It's not made. Hmm. You can only do so much. Really, you have a cow and it gives you cream and then you make butter out of it essentially by beating up the cream. There's not all that much to it. So it's essentially kind of a pure presentation of the animal and the land that it comes from and the person who makes it. But as with wine, there's not that much intervention.
What does great butter taste like to you?
Well, I think there's this great, creamy, sweet opening. And then especially with cultured butter, you get this great tangy sour note in the middle. Then there's this long finish that sometimes reminds me of hazelnuts. Mm. It's just, it's very complete and really fun and just incredibly delicious.
And you spent time with a renowned butter maker for your story. Her name is Diane St. Clair, right?
I did. In November, I went to Vermont to a little town called Orwell, which is on the western side of the state where she has her dairy farm. And it was basically, you know, I just remember driving for what seemed like half an hour down a service road and finally seeing her house. And it was pelting rain, and I remember her coming out wearing rubber boots, dressed like a New England farmer, and taking me into her barn. And there were 11 Jersey cows, and basically we spent most of that day ankle deep in mud, trudging around her pasture in her barn, in the little creamery that she has right off the barn. And we talked about butter and made some butter and tasted some butter. But my sense of Diane was that she was a true believer. It was really like spending a time with somebody who cares about this one aspect of their life so deeply that she spends all of her time with her animals. These 11 Jersey cows for her, I think, are more like children than livestock. She spends more time caring for them, feeding them, milking them, petting them, talking to them than anyone I've ever seen. It was really like watching somebody with 11 very large dogs.
So, but what makes her butter fantastic? Is there like a move she does when she churns it? Is there a technique? Is there a culture she uses? Like, what is it that makes her butter great?
Well, I asked her that same question because, you know, what's your trick? And I think what she told me is that there is no trick, that the trick is getting the very best cream you can. Because once you have the cream, there's not all that much you can do with it. Culturing butter is essentially just letting the cream ferment a little bit, letting it go a little bit sour to give it a little bit more flavor. And she does do that, and then she uses a small mixer to churn the butter. But mostly it is the animals. It is the Jersey cows, which are these light brown cows. They're not very popular with most large commercial butter makers because they don't give as much milk as the Holsteins, which are the cows we know from children's books, the black and white spotted cows, which are much more productive. They give a lot more milk, but the milk isn't quite as rich. And Diane explained to me that the dandelion yellow color of her butter is also the result of the Jersey cows. They give a darker cream, which creates a darker colored butter. And several other butter makers also use Jerseys because they just claim it gives a sort of a richer cream than the Holsteins do. But of course, that's just a tiny part of the equation. I think she is fanatical about the feed that she gives to her cows. In the spring, the cows eat grass in the pasture. In the winter and late fall months, they eat hay. She doesn't give them silage, which is fermented hay, which a lot of farmers feed their cows in the winters. But I think it's just the attention that she gives to these animals. You know, they seemed so well looked after, so cared about, so thought about. And I'm not trying to be mystical. I'm not trying to suggest that happy cows give incredible butter. But there isn't any trick. There isn't any butter making technique that I witnessed. Her creamery is about the size of a large bathroom. It's got a industrial refrigerator in it and a sink and a mixer and some thermometers. There's really nothing. There's no magical laboratory. She cares a lot for the land. She cares a lot for her cows. And maybe she was being coy. I don't rule that out. Diane struck me as a very ambitious person in a lot of ways, by which I mean artistically ambitious, not commercially ambitious. I think if she wanted to make a lot more money and, you know, get another 100 jerseys, she probably could. But this is how she likes to do it. I think her operation is pretty much her.
Yeah.
There weren't a lot of farm hands that I saw. I think she likes to kind of do this by herself. And she's very adamant that, like a winemaker, she says that the only thing that makes great butter is great cream, great ingredients.
She sounds really, really fascinating.
She is. And her butter is, it's definitely the most intense I've ever tasted. It's a little unusual. It has almost the consistency of vanilla ice cream rather than this kind of dense block that we're used to.
Yeah.
But it is the most flavorful butter I've ever tasted. And I could totally see why somebody would plunk down $50 for a bag of it, which is not an easy thing to do.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming in today, Alex.
My pleasure, Francis.
Great to see you.
Alex Halberstadt is the author of Lonely Avenue and writes for the New York Times Magazine, Travel and Leisure, and Saveur. You can find his story on butter at saveur.com. And if you have some butter to spare, go to our website, splendidtable.org, for a great recipe for butter poached shrimp with grits from Michael Ruhlman. And we will be back with your calls and a whole bunch of stuff about onions. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Francis Lamb. Okay, everyone gather around. It's time for us to have a little talk. Get to us any way you like. 1-800-537-5252. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, or email us at contact@splendidtable.org. Let us know what you're working on in your kitchen or what you're trying to figure out. All right, let's get going. We have Kathy on the line from the Ozark Mountains in Arkansas. Hey, Kathy.
Well,
what can
hi,
we talk about?
Francis. It's nice to talk to you. I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
I'm great, thank you.
Good.
What shall we discuss?
Well, someone gave me what I think is a big can of anchovies. And I don't have very much I like anchovies, the little small ones I've gotten on pizza, that sort of thing, or anchovy paste and things, or maybe in, what is it, in Caesar salad dressing?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. This can, though, is like 14 ounces, and it says it contains 4 anchovy fillets, olive oil, and salt. And before I open this big can, I want to know what I can do with them or how I can keep them longer if I don't use them all up at the first whack, you know?
Sure. Well, someone gave me a big can of anchovy is the beginning of a great Southern Gothic short story. So this is...
Okay.
And wait, did you say there were 4 anchovies in the can? Is it
that's
4?
That's... And I'm looking at a picture of the can because I'm at work, but I had taken a picture so I could, like, look stuff up on it.
Yeah.
Oh, no, it has 6 pieces. I'm sorry.
Okay.
All right. Sorry about that.
No
6
problem.
Pieces.
But even 6 anchovies to a 14-ounce can, I mean, these are like the great white shark of anchovies, it sounds like. And I have to confess, I've never seen that kind of anchovy before. And, man, but okay, so let's assume, despite their size, they will kind of act like regular anchovies.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, I adore anchovies. I truly, truly love them. And I never really understood why they have such a bad rap until actually, because you mentioned pizza, I got a pizza recently, got anchovies on it. And I was like, whoa, those do not smell like beautiful salty fish anymore. Like,
okay.
Those smell like maybe a salty fish's locker room. And, you know, they had that like metallic flavor and they were too salty. I was like, oh, this is why people hate these things.
That's why my husband doesn't like them.
but that's such a bummer because a good anchovy, and I assume if this is like giftable anchovy, it's going to be, they're going to be great, is so delicious. And I think there's so many things you can do with them and things you can do with them that do not scream, hey, I'm an anchovy.
Oh, good.
They'll just make things tastier and they'll make things more savory and add a real depth of flavor without that sort of intimidating quality. And I think the most basic way to kind of bring that aspect of anchovies out is to basically melt them in hot oil or hot fat. And it's a weird thing, but they do tend to dissolve and almost melt, not like liquid plastic lava, but they'll just kind of dissolve. If you have a pan of olive oil, or I love them in butter, get it hot, not blazing hot, but, you know, just kind of get the oil nice and warm, the fat nice and warm, the butter's maybe melted and foamy.
Okay.
And you drop... You can start with one little fillet, or if they're big, like you say, like just kind of cut them into regular anchovy fillet size, I guess. and just kind of saute them lightly, and you'll see that they will start to disintegrate.
Okay.
And they'll kind of toast, and they'll brown, and you'll get so many of those rich browned flavors. They add that nice saltiness. And if you then put garlic, onions, you know, you can start a sauce like that. It's a great way to start a tomato sauce, in fact.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, if you're just doing like a normal tomato sauce, like a marinara type of sauce, but start it with a couple anchovies, it adds a real deep, beautiful layer of flavor. So yeah, I would start playing with those kinds of things. Anything you would start in a pan with onions and garlic and could use a little depth, maybe drop a fillet or two. I mean, in some cases, you know, you can go bananas. I mean, there are whole pastas, you know, many a pasta dinner I've eaten where it's just, you know, half a dozen anchovy fillets and olive oil and garlic and toss it with a bunch of pasta and maybe a little bit of herbs on top and a squeeze of lemon juice. And I'm like the happiest camper on the block. So it's just a great way to add an initial base of flavor that just you'll taste all the way throughout, but won't be like, hey, I'm anchovy. You know what I mean?
Okay. Well, that is great. I really appreciate it. I'm going to try making maybe a tomato sauce first and seeing how I like that and either keeping the anchovies longer or maybe making up some more of that tomato sauce and freezing it. Does tomato sauce freeze?
Yeah, beautifully.
Okay. Well, good. You've helped me a lot.
Oh, my pleasure. And if you really want to get adventurous and if you really like them, then what I suggest doing one time is mashing them up in cold butter.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this buttery anchovy flavor.
Mm-hmm.
And then next time you grill a steak, throw a little pat of that butter on top of the steak and kind of let it melt on top right before you serve it.
Oh, that sounds good.
Yeah, it's real good.
See, I can take that. I can do that. At my parents' house, they like anchovies.
Perfect.
They like anchovies.
Perfect.
I want to serve them up to people that really like anchovies.
Yeah, for sure. If it's a gift, and you know, you gotta share the gift.
Thank you, Francis.
Take care. Thanks for the call.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye. Call us at 1-800-537-5252. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter, or you can always email us. Of course, contact@splendidtable.org. We have Lauren from Columbia, South Carolina on the line. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, Francis. My question today is about cast iron cookware. So I have a cast iron skillet, and it seems like I'm doing all the right things, but I can't get the seasoning to stay on. I try to cook bacon and all those good fatty things in it to keep the seasoning going. I don't wash it with soap, and I dry it thoroughly, and I oil it down after I use it, and it always looks good and feels good afterwards, but when I start cooking with it, I get kind of a black crust on the middle of the skillet, and my food sticks and doesn't really cook evenly, so I'm hoping you can help me.
Okay, so first, I think I have to say that I adore cast iron, and there is definitely like a cult of seasoning cast iron, and you have to do it only with your left hand, and you have to like dance three times around it before you do it. You know, there are all these like myths
about
the perfect way to do it, and otherwise, you know, it's gonna like grab onto your food, hold it prisoner, and burn it all. You know, and I think I have to say that most of that stuff is bunk, and one of the myths that I think really keeps holding people's attention is, oh, a good cast iron skillet is basically like the best non-stick skillet ever. And the fact is a really well-seasoned cast iron skillet does have non-stick properties, but it's never going to be like a non-stick pan like you buy at the store.
Okay.
So that's one thing to say. And when you use it, and you say the food is sticking, do you get the skillet really nice and hot before you add the food?
I do. I try to get it as hot as I can. And then, you know, I always oil it, obviously, but it's like the oil just kind of absorbs immediately.
Oh, interesting.
Into that crust.
And you say you don't wash it with soap and you use it often, which is really the key. But so maybe try to give it another just plain seasoning step.
Okay.
You know, try like the 400, 450 degree oven. Rub the inside with oil. really whatever oil you want to use is fine. People talk about you have to use this, you have to use that. Like whatever cooking oil you have is fine. When I did mine, I just happened to have some shortening. So I used that. And it seemed to work great, but I don't think that that particularly works better or worse than anything else.
Okay.
And then, yeah, bake it for maybe like, you know, 20 minutes, a half hour. It might start to smell a little bit, might start to smoke. Take it out, let it cool. And maybe repeat that a couple times. And then, like you said, just keep, you know, just keep frying bacon in there.
Any excuse to fry bacon, right?
Yeah, maybe it'll just be your bacon pan for a little while, and eventually all that fat will adhere to it and get your good seasoning. I hope. I mean, it sounds like it's a complicated situation that there isn't a super
easy fix for. I found it to be a little bit finicky. And I guess I always expected, you know, if I treat it right, it will be like a nonstick skillet. And maybe I just have the wrong expectations.
Yeah, it never really gets quite that way. It can get to the point where, like, food will seem to slide out of it easily, or, you know, you can get a really good sear on a piece of meat. But typically that can happen in any pan as long as the pan's really hot enough.
Right.
So it's a little bit of a misconception that it becomes, quote unquote, nonstick, because it's never going to be like a Teflon pan.
Well, that's good to know.
But keep, try those seasoning, you know, that seasoning step a couple times. Keep frying bacon in there. Like, I fry chicken in mine, and then that gives it a nice coating. And really just cook a lot in it. And especially in the initial stages, if you're frying things in it, because there's a lot of nice fat to kind of spread around in there.
Okay.
Yeah, and good luck.
Thank you.
And thanks for the call.
Thanks. Have a good day.
Always feel free to call us at 1-800-537-5252. So, my mom doesn't make a lot of friends in restaurants. She's a vegetarian who also can't have onions or garlic or shallots or scallions or anything else in the Allium family. So, whenever we go out, I always, always, always call ahead to ask the restaurant if that's okay. But I remember once when I was a kid, she told the server about her diet and the chef straight up kicked us out of the restaurant. Like, he was so infuriated that we asked him to cook without onions that he couldn't abide us breathing the same air anymore. And, you know, it was a bad look, hospitality-wise, but honestly, I don't entirely blame him, because in so many dishes, obviously you know, starting the pan with onions is the backbone. So much so that that action of cooking onions and garlic gets hardwired into your brain. But here's the thing about things that are hardwired. You know, they become invisible. I mean that you just start doing them and you don't really give them any thought. Well, that's why I think Kate Winslow has written a great book. It's called Onions, Etc., and it's literally an entire cookbook devoted to how to think about onions, to feature them as a food rather than a flavoring. Our friend Joe Yonan, food editor of the Washington Post, sat down with Kate to talk about the good stink.
Kate, thanks so much for coming in to talk to us today.
Oh, it's such a pleasure. Thank you.
I love that you write that many times you start chopping an onion before you even know what you're going to make.
And yes.
I think so many of us identify with that. You know, the garlic and onion go into the olive oil as we're trying to figure out what else we're going to put in there.
Exactly. You know, as you're sort of rummaging through the pantry and seeing if it's going to be a tomato sauce, or if you're going to make some beans, or you're going to, you know, add some meat in there, and or a stir fry, something like that. And it just helps you buy some time. You know, you're gonna need it anyway, so you might as well get started.
Let's talk about those workhorses, those storage onions that we're all so familiar with, the white onion and the yellow onion. Mm-hmm. Can you describe the differences between them?
Well, the yellow onion, you know, the flavor of yellow onions, white onions, and even red onions, they're not terribly different. And they can be used pretty interchangeably. They all, you know, earlier in the season, they're all going to be milder, a little sweeter. As they age and cure, they're going to become more pungent. Yellow onions, I think, really work best when you're cooking them. They really melt down into that sweet pile of golden caramel. White onions are very, very crisp. They have a thinner skin, and they're really good raw. Their color stays nice and white. You find them in a lot of Latin American dishes, used in a lot of salsas. Same thing with red onions. I mean, they have that beautiful punch of color, and I like using them raw a lot or grilling them a little bit, which makes their color pop even more. Pickling them does the same. If you're serving them raw, but you want to cut that bite a little bit, you can soak them in some cold water, and that helps just gentle their pungency.
Kate, I am so drawn to what you refer to as the lean greens in your book, the scallions, chives, and the like. What do you like about those?
We eat with our eyes first, and that beautiful green really does get you. And I think that's wonderful. And then I think what a lot of people love is that they're really easy to work with. You don't have to peel them, and they don't make you tear up so much as sometimes a bulb onion does.
Your chapter for the lean greens has some really incredible looking recipes. I was loving the look of that four onion dip, you call it, which, I don't know, maybe it should be called a four allium dip, but
I guess so, yeah, because it has garlic in it. Yep.
Right. Can you tell us how you make that?
Sure. You know, it starts with a totally traditional sour cream base, but we saute some onions, finely chopped onions, and you could use yellow, you could use sweet, you could use red, and some sauteed garlic too. And then you're going to fold into that some finely chopped fresh scallions and lots of black pepper, a drizzle of Worcestershire sauce and some lemon, fresh lemon. And then you top it with lots of chopped chives. So you're getting that extra last bit of allium as you dip your potato chip in there.
Great.
It's good. It's good.
You have some incredible other recipes in other chapters, like those gorgeous red onion blossoms,
yes,
which I thought were a stunning idea. Can you describe those?
Sure. That is a real show-stopping dish, which I like because, you know, as we're talking about onions being a workhorse, it's nice to remember they can also be pretty glamorous looking. And so this is taking a whole red onion and making six cuts into it from the blossom to the stem end or to the root end, but so it stays intact. Sprinkling a little salt and pepper inside there and drizzling it with some white balsamic vinegar and some olive oil, and then wrapping it all up in foil and putting it in the oven to roast. And so it roasts for, you know, 20 minutes or so until it gets soft, and you take it out and you unwrap it, trying to keep all those juices that have collected in there along with the oil and vinegar. And as you unwrap it, it just sort of slumps open and creates this beautiful blossom effect. It looks just like almost like a lotus flower, and the color has really popped with that bit of heat and the acid from the vinegar. So it's delicious alongside a steak or some roast chicken or other vegetables.
I looked at it and thought that Outback Steakhouse really has something to worry about.
Yeah.
No blooming onions.
You don't need a blooming onion when you have an onion blossom.
No, yeah. No. So I'm a taco fanatic, and I'm an onion fanatic, and I never would have thought to make onion tacos.
Yes.
How did you come up with that?
That was several years ago. I was in Pittsburgh, and I went out to a taco restaurant in town one night, and on the menu was just something called an onion taco, and I had to order it. And it was just the most simple dish of some really super soft, buttery grilled onions that were just folded into hot corn tortillas and topped just with a little bit of queso fresco and some salsa. And it was so simple and so satisfying. Ever since then, it's become, you know, something we make all the time. We fire up the grill, we put extra onions on there, and you can just fold them into tortillas. And they're meaty. I mean, when you cut them thick like that, they really have such a nice presence and are very satisfying.
That just is a beautiful thing. Kate, thank you so much for talking to us about this beautiful book.
Oh, Joe, thank you. What a treat it was to be here.
Kate Winslow is the author of Onions, Etc. Joe Yonan is the author of Eat Your Vegetables. And you can find Kate's recipes for four onion dip and for red onion blossoms at splendidtable.org. And while you're there, I've got a simple little video on how to cut an onion in case that might ever come in handy for you. And that's the show for our week. Thanks so much for listening. And in the meantime, let me leave you with this statement from the queen herself, Beyoncé. I got hot sauce in my bag. Swag. Our show is produced by APM, American Public Media. For information on anything you heard here today, go to splendidtable.org. Take a look at our recipe collection, sign up for our weekly email, Weeknight Kitchen, and don't forget to subscribe to our podcast. Our production team includes senior producer Jennifer Russell. Jenny J. Lou Lubke is our editor and technical director. Erica Romero is our assistant producer. Chip Walton is our digital associate producer. And Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.